what's happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
The Shasta College Art Gallery presents a Japanese woodblock print exhibition featuring works from the traditional ukiyo-e period to contemporary artists. Explore beautifully crafted prints with many pieces available for purchase to support Shasta College Student Show Awards. Join us for the closing reception on April 16th at noon in Building 300 during Shasta College Cultural Day. The gallery is open Monday through Thursday 8 to 5 and Fridays 8 to noon. More information can be found at shastacollege.edu/events.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
When you're looking to appoint a judge, some attorney who's really bright, but willing to make $200,000 a year when he could be making, or she could be making, millions of dollars a year, where do you find somebody like that? It's the same kind of person who is such a cause person that they would actually donate their time, like they do with us, to defend the First Amendment.
This is your host, Scott Bertrand. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. That was Kelly Shackelford, President and CEO of First Liberty Institute. We talk with him in depth about religious liberty and religious freedom today. Later on in today's program, Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin from Hillsdale's English Department joins us to begin a brief series on Emily Dickinson. First, we're joined by Kelly Shackelford. He's President and Chief Executive Officer of First Liberty Institute. Find them at firstliberty.org. A constitutional scholar, he's argued before the U.S. Supreme Court multiple times, also recently appointed by President Trump to serve on the Religious Liberty Commission, and we'll talk a bit about that later on in our conversation. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, happy to do it.
Having a conversation today about religious liberty, where we were, where we are, where we might be in the future in the country. For listeners who might not follow this sort of legal conversation closely, how do you define religious liberty in simple terms, and what does it protect in our everyday life?
Well, it's the first freedom. Our country was built on religious freedom. It's the first two clauses of the First Amendment. And what I always like to start with on religious freedom is, what if you're not religious? Should you care about this? The answer is absolutely. It was called our first freedom because our founders understood that if you lose this freedom, which is really freedom of conscience, you'll lose all your freedoms. You'll lose your free speech rights. You'll lose your, you know, property rights. You'll lose, you know, you name it. It's gone. And the best way I can describe why that is true is that the one thing that a totalitarian regime will never allow are citizens who hold an allegiance to one higher than the government. So whenever that type of tyranny comes in, that coalescing of power, the first flashpoint will always be these people who won't bow their knee to the government. And if you lose there, you'll lose everything else. And it's actually interesting, as I speak all over the world, really, but especially in our country, a lot of times I'll have people come up to me and they'll say they're from, name the, you know, Eastern European country. And they say, I saw this happen. I'm thinking of a guy right now who came up and said, you know, I think that what you guys are doing is the most important thing anybody's doing in the country. He said, I'm not religious. He said, but I was in Czechoslovakia. And he said, I saw them take down the religious symbols, and within a month, we all lost our political freedoms. And he handed me a check. I said, I'm going to be supporting your foundation for, you know, from now on. And he's not even a person of faith. He just understands its centrality to all of your other freedoms. And so it's like the thing that tells you whether you're in danger with all your freedoms. And so I think that helps. It's something everybody should care about and everybody should fight for, even if you're not religious.
Let's talk about the founders a little bit. What was the original design behind the religion clauses in the First Amendment? What did the founders think that religious liberty was for?
Well, they came from England, and they had the Church of England. And of course, you know, there's, I think most people know a lot of the history. I mean, Tyndale was, you know, executed. And so they wanted religious freedom. I mean, the Puritans came over. I mean, we ended up having Quakers and you know, Baptists and lots of different denominations that came to America for freedom. And so that's why they put in the very first two clauses of the First Amendment, you know, a good quiz for people is name your, you know, the five rights laid out in the First Amendment. And everybody knows free speech, but that's usually where they stop. Uh-huh. But the first two are religious freedom. It's that, you know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. They did not want a Church of England. They did not want a national church, right? Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So they wanted the fullest, freest, free exercise of religion that we could have. And they knew that if you had a national church, that would take away from that, that they would start telling you what you had to do towards that church, that denomination. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what the founders were after. So you saw a lot of religion in the founders. I mean, they had a chaplain there that was paid out of the federal treasury. So it's not that they were anti-religious. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a civic religion that we're all, it's okay to be religious. Religion is a good thing, but we don't want the government picking sides. And that's what they laid in place.
Talking with Kelly Shackelford, who's president and chief executive officer of First Liberty Institute, firstliberty.org. How quickly or when did things begin to shift in America such that religious liberty became more contested?
Well, I would say, behind all of this is what was going on in our country culturally, right? It wasn't that the law should have changed. I mean, it's just all of a sudden you had judges start to reinterpret things in the Constitution, almost like a pastor would reinterpret the Bible to make it a little more convenient for what they wanted.
A living Bible.
Exactly. Yeah, just like the living Constitution, which, of course, there's no such thing. And what I would say is if you looked at the cases, it would start in the 1940s.
Okay.
They laid the groundwork. But it was just some words that I think were, it's in the Everson case, where in that case, really what was going on, and it shows the dangers, why you should never use religious freedom to sort of almost take away religious freedom from another religion mm-hmm. than yours, because it will come back to haunt you. What was happening in that case is most schools in the United States were, you know, public schools were really somewhat Protestant. They would have prayer. And so there were other schools formed. You know, private schools, they were typically Catholic as a different place. And this in New Jersey, they had, they said, we're going to reimburse you for your busing to private schools. And, the argument was, well, that you can't do that. And again, these are mostly Protestant people pushing this. And the result is this opinion, it actually upheld the practice. So it didn't sort of go into this dangerous sort of hostile fundamentalist separation of church and state, meaning anytime the government touches religion, you squelch religion.
Mm-hmm.
But the language they laid out was really sloppy, and it allowed when they got to the 60s, where there was much more sort of hostility to religion at that point and a cultural shift. And so some really bad case law that wasn't based upon what the founders said, what the founders did, was put in place. And Lemon was sort of the chief case of this. Lemon is aptly named. It created a test that sort of tried to create this fundamentalist wall of separation between religion and government.
Mm-hmm.
So religion, wherever government is, religion can't be. Well, of course, number one, that's not what the founders said. But the government is everywhere.
Yeah.
So this is a way to push religious expression into the corners of society. So fortunately, we've won a number of Supreme Court cases in the last few years, and one of those was the Coach Kennedy case. The coach who
He's been on the show, by the way.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry for you. He's a crazy man. he's a lot of fun. He likes to poke the bear. Coach Kennedy, what a lot of people don't know is, yes, he won his case. Yes, he has a right to go to a knee by himself after mm-hmm. the football game. But within that decision, the Lemon case was reversed. 50 years it's been in place, over 7,000 citations by federal courts to squelch religious freedom through that. Well, it's gone. So what that means is everywhere that a cross was taken down,
mm-hmm.
it can come back up. You know, Ten Commandments that were pushed in the closet, they can come back out. Nativity scenes at Christmas are okay. you know, menorahs at Hanukkah are okay. And we're just starting this process. There'll be more cases because people don't understand what the decision really said. So you're seeing a number of states requiring that they put up like a poster or things of the Ten Commandments to teach the kids. Mm-hmm. And then there are people saying, oh, you can't do that. And it's like, look, I understand if you want to change the country from what it was founded on, that's your freedom to try to do that. But to not teach kids, I mean, it's like reading Shakespeare. There's over 1,200 references to the Bible in Shakespeare. If you don't understand what those things are, you're really missing out a lot on what you read. So I think there's a pretty significant change occurring. And that Lemon case being overturned is one of the big changes in just the last 3 to 4 years.
That's Kelly Shackelford from First Liberty Institute. More with him in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Cool April Nights kicks off this Friday with our downtown event, Spring Fest, including a walkabout blues concert, 4 to 9 p.m. Make sure to go to CoolAprilNights.com for a full schedule of events. Over 50 show and shines this year, 3 concerts, and 10 days of classic car fun. That's Cool April Nights Spring Fest downtown kickoff this Friday for Cool April Nights. 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. downtown Reading, right on Market Street. CoolLaborNights.com for a full downloadable schedule of events.
Hi, this is Cindy at Lauk's Landscape Supply. Spring is sprung, and it's time for our annual spring sale, April 10th through the 19th at Lauk's Landscape Supply. Save big on the North State Turfland lawn seed and get a 25-pound bag for only $49.99. Our popular garden power soil will be down to $51.99 a yard. Need to restock the tools in the shed? 15 to 20% off all the popular shovels, rakes, garden hoses, and so much more in the store. Pick up a 2.5-gallon jug of Ranger Pro Concentrate to kill those weeds for only $59.99 each. A 5-cubic foot contractor's blue steel wheelbarrow for only $199.99. Landscape fabric in all sizes marked at the lowest price of the year. Triple 15 is only $27.99 for a 50-pound bag. This and so much more at Lauk's Landscape Supply at the intersection of Dersh, Churn Creek, and Airport Road. Give us a call at 530-378-2220. Check us out on the web at laukslandscapesupply.com or just come see us at 6023 Churn Creek Road, April 10th through the 19th. Lauk's Landscape Supply, where we take pride in your project.
It's time to settle up and ride west. Wind River Resort and Casino is proud to bring Wyoming's own Ian Munsick to the Event Center stage. Friday, July 24th. Rising fast and bringing his signature sound. Ian brings the west to the rest. Tickets are just $60 plus fee. But they won't last long, so don't wait. Make it a country night to remember. Call 1-800-280-UWIN to reserve your room and grab your ticket. Off those boots. Grab your hat and find your moment at Wind River Resort and Casino.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. 3 locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the 3rd generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Kelly Shackelford is our guest today. He's President and Chief Executive Officer of First Liberty Institute. You can find more at firstliberty.org, talking religious liberty and religious freedom with Kelly Shackelford. Kelly, some of these arguments that we hear these days, and you reference this, and it's one that's old as time, this idea that, hey, it's right there in the Constitution, separation of church and state. And we've talked on this show previously with guests about where that comes from and how it sort of got sucked into this argument. So when people say that, make that argument, what do they really mean, even if they're not referencing a correct thing? And is there any sort of backing, is there a leg to stand on for that type of argument?
Yeah, I mean, number one, of course, people need to understand it's not in the Constitution. There's an establishment clause that we didn't want the government to establish a national church. The concept, separation of church and state, and the reason I mentioned some of those cases, that Everson case was one of the first cases that really brought it in on the side of the establishment clause as a way to discuss it, which, again, was sloppy because it's not a very good tool. The concept, though, was back to some of our founders who, what they were saying is the separation of the institution of the church from the institution of the state. And that is, they didn't want the government controlling the church, and they didn't want one church controlling the government. And so that's fine. I think most everybody would agree with that. The problem is that's not how they use it. They'll say the term, the average American will say the term, and then take Coach Kennedy. We'll say, in fact, I mean, one of the justices or a few of the justices in the dissent said, this is a horrible decision, you know, allowing him to pray by himself. It's a horrible decision for separation of church and state. This is a justice of the Supreme Court. And you're like, okay, let's sit down a second here, okay? Please tell me where the church is.
Right.
There's no church. It's Coach Kennedy and his private expression. So this is a total, even when they use the term, which is not in the Constitution, they mangle it horribly, because what they do is they create a separation of religion and any government. And of course, government's everywhere, which means religion gets pushed into the corners of society.
And it also extends to my next question, which is, there is an argument that also goes essentially like this, which is, hey, you're free to believe what you want to believe. That's your freedom of religion. But the moment you begin to act on it or live your life consistent with those beliefs, that's when we should jump in and stop you from doing so.
Yeah, there are actually judges who have said that in their opinions. And I find it incredibly embarrassing for them. You know, because when I'm in those oral arguments or whatever with a judge, I'll usually respond, you know, I wasn't aware that it's the free belief clause. It's the free exercise clause. I mean, the First Amendment protects the free exercise of religion. The founders were very specific. You know, they weren't saying we're just going to protect your right to believe something. We're going to actually protect your right to live it out. And that's really what religious freedom is all about in this country, is not just some right to, you know, for the, you know, you have some government that can force you to do whatever they want you to do, even if it violates your faith. And that's one of the changes I've seen in the 37 years I've been doing this. I'd say in the beginning, a lot of the cases were somebody's doing something. The government says you can't do that. And they're saying, but I'm doing this because of my faith. And then you would fight that out in court on where to draw that line. Now what's happening is the government is trying to tell people, we want you to do this thing that violates your faith, and we want to force you to violate your conscience and your faith. And you know, you nurse, you have to do this abortion, right? You know, Christian school, you have to allow boys on the girls' team, even though it violates your faith. And a lot of times it's not necessary in a lot of the cases even for that person to do it. I mean, take a nurse. There's plenty of nurses that don't have a problem, but it's really important for them to force the citizen to violate their faith and conscience.
That's the entire Jack Phillips case in Colorado, where they keep going back again and again and again to the same person to drag them back into court.
Yes.
You won't bake the cake. Kelly Shackelford with us from First Liberty Institute, firstliberty.org, on the topic of schools. We have this new federal tax credit scholarship program that was in a big, beautiful bill, which is now law, and some governors have opted in. Others are still considering. There are some governors, one in particular in Illinois, who have sent text messages to other members saying, we shouldn't do this. I'm very worried because some of these schools teach things that we don't agree with, and perhaps we shouldn't be funneling money or helping funnel money to those schools. What's case law say about this? Are we headed back to court, perhaps back to the Supreme Court over this federal tax credit scholarship program?
No, we wouldn't. I mean, if we are, it's an easy win. We had a case, First Liberty had a case just a few years ago called Carson versus Macon. The state of Maine had a school choice program, has had it for like 130 years. If you go to Maine, most school districts do not have a public school.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they give the money to the parents and they say, pick whatever public or private school. Even you can even pick an out-of-state private school if you want. But then after like 100 years, they decided they'd make one change. But we're not going to allow you to pick any religious schools. And we took that case to the Supreme Court and won 6-3.
Hmm.
It's religious discrimination and it's unconstitutional. So I think it's very clear at this point that in any school choice program that exists in the country, the parents have a right to pick the Christian or the religious school if they so choose. So it really, this argument by, you mentioned the governor of Illinois, it's such an incredibly, I mean, I think it's an arrogant argument, but it's a foolish argument. It's not like somebody else is picking what's best for their kids.
Mm-hmm.
What he's really saying is you parents, you know, I know better than you for your children. I mean, the arrogance of that is unbelievable to me. You don't even know my children, you know, leave me alone. I mean, that's kind of the response. Even the most well-intentioned bureaucrat will never love and care for their children like their parents. And so giving the parents the authority to make the decision. I mean, I know with my own children, we put them all in different schools at different times,
right,
based upon who they were, what they needed, what the situation is. The centralized government can never do that, you know, and it's sort of the difference between socialism and capitalism. You need the decisions made not at some central location way away,
uh-huh,
but by the people who are actually involved in whatever transaction that is. To give parents the right will actually not only be the best for their kids, but will actually improve the schools. Because when consumers are able to make decisions, then it changes. But if you got a monopoly like a public school and you can just do whatever you want and you're not even having to compete over the taxpayer money with the private schools, why should you improve things?
Yeah.
So school choice is, I think, one of the biggest issues for changing the quality of education and really freedom in our country. So I always tell people we've always had school choice. It's just been for people with money. And what the school choice movement is about really is letting every parent make the best decision, creating competition, improving all the schools.
We'll return for a few more minutes with Kelly Shackelford from First Liberty Institute. We ask him about First Liberty next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The only real estate agent I trust right here in Redding and Shasta County is Josh Barker with Josh Barker Real Estate. Now, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
So what trends do you anticipate will shape the real estate market in 2026 based on what you've seen in late 2025? And how should buyers and sellers adjust their strategies accordingly?
Well, that's an excellent question, Sean. And I think what most experts are saying right now is that the first half of this year will probably be very similar to last year in terms of sales volume and performance. The difference and the separation might be in the second half of the year, where we might see sales volumes actually increasing over last year as lower interest rates and perhaps some momentum in the economy starts to kick in. And if you want to check the value of your home instantly, just go to readinghomes.com. It's right there on the front page for you.
All right. Thanks for keeping us up to date. Go online to readinghomes.com. That's Redding, R-E-D-D-I-N-G, homes.com, or just Google Josh Barker.
Turtle Bay's glowing wild and illuminated Wildlife Lantern Festival is back and better than ever for 2026 at the Sundial Bridge in Redding, California.
Featuring 10 acres of illuminated gardens filled with larger-than-life displays of plants and animals from around the world,
including dinosaurs and icons from ancient Egypt.
Jump on the new Turtle Express for a fun ride through the show.
Glowing Wild is May 1st through June 28th, 7 to 10 p.m. Buy tickets online for the best price at turtlebay.org.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Hi, this is Carrie Grawl. This season marks a new chapter for Organic Pilates, a rebirth of sorts in a new, larger downtown space. Alongside it, we want to introduce you to Harmony, a lifestyle boutique created as a natural extension of how we move and live with intention. We want to invite you in. Harmony and Organic Pilates, now open in downtown Reading. We're located at 1264 California Street in between Curated and Theory Coffee. We can't wait to see you.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Kelly Shackelford, President and Chief Executive Officer of First Liberty Institute, more at firstliberty.org. He's also a member of President Donald Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. More on that in a few moments. Kelly, tell us about First Liberty Institute. There are a number of great organizations that do First Amendment work and religious liberty work, so why does First Liberty Institute exist? What gap was it trying to fill? Is it trying to fill?
Yeah, First Liberty is the largest legal nonprofit in the country that all we do is religious freedom. So we have synagogue cases, we have church cases, we have, have represented all faiths. And I'd say one of the secrets to how we're different is our model of how we do the cases. Every other nonprofit legal group in the country, and I don't care if they're left wing or right wing or what their issue is, whether it's a Sierra Club or a property rights group or whatever, they have the same model, which is raise money, use the money to hire attorneys, put them in an office in D.C. or L.A. or New York, and then fly them around and cover the cases. That's not our model. Our model is there's all these people of faith who went to law school because they wanted to stand for what was right. And 30 years later, these are the best litigators at the best law firms in the country. And they've done honorable work, but they've never gotten to do a case for their faith or their country. So we go and sit down with them and we say, look, if we bring you everything you need on our staff or top of their class from all the best law schools and all they do is religious freedom, these are always media cases. We have a whole media team that will come around you. We'll pay all your out-of-pockets, your expert fees, everything. If we bring you everything you need, are you willing to give your time and bring your law firm? And they're like, man, I've been waiting my whole life, sign me up. And the result of that is fairly dramatic. Number one, average case, every 10,000 we spend, we get 60,000 donated. So it's a real multiplication of resources. But more importantly is the win-loss ratio. If you look at legal nonprofits, they are created to fight big problems, industry, government. If they win a case, it's a big deal. If they win like 40% of cases, that's really, really great. Our win rate now, every single year for 26 years in a row, has been above 90%. And that's, I mean, that's God's favor, but it's also the method of how this is done. I mean, when we have a case in, you know, Idaho, our attorney is from the best law firm in Idaho. You know, this is one of the best litigators in the state, and our team comes along with them. And so when they go into court, like, that attorney looks at the judge, and that was like a classmate. They lost a tooth together in first grade. You know? So that's very different from flying somebody in from across the country who's a foreigner. So this method is what's one of the things that's really different about First Liberty. We always have these unique teams of our attorneys with wherever jurisdiction we are, the best people there. And that sort of resulted in some other things. Like one of the things we do, we have the most extensive judicial vetting operation in the country. We vet all the federal judges. We just want to make sure that people don't go on the court who are anti-religious freedom. And so we have a lot of data. We have more than anybody in the country. And guess what? When you're looking to appoint a judge, some attorney who's really bright but willing to make $200,000 a year when he could be making or she could be making millions of dollars a year, where do you find somebody like that? It's the same kind of person who is such a cause person that they would actually donate their time, like they do with us, to defend the First Amendment. And so a lot of our people are becoming federal judges and have become federal judges.
There's been a number of wins at the Supreme Court level the past decade or so. You mentioned the Lemon precedent being overturned. There's the Coach Prayer case. There's the Phillips case. There's the case, I think it was an Iowa school getting funding for their playground, but they were religious. They So all these are wins at the Supreme Court. Should we feel good about things? Are we in a better place than we were 20, 25 years ago when it comes to religious freedom and religious liberty?
It's sort of twofold. The attacks are more vicious than they've ever been. We had 491 cases last year. 10 years ago, it might have been we had, 150 cases. We could have more if we had more resources. We just do what we can. But the good news, even though the attack, and people can see how vicious the attacks are, the good news is, as I said, we're in a really unique moment in time. We are expanding religious freedom. There are cases that we are overturning right now that when I was in law school, I thought, and rightfully so, I thought, there's no way we'll overturn that case in my lifetime. We can pick away at it. It's bad, but it's just had so many citations to it, and it's such an entrenched precedent that it won't be overturned. And we're overturning them. And I'll tell you an example of this to help people understand. On average, about 6,000 requests a year at the U.S. Supreme Court to take your case. They took 56 last year. So your odds are not good for them to take your case. We just argued a case in December that we just won last week. 2 days after that argument, we won another case at the Supreme Court. We won 4 cases at the U.S. Supreme Court in 13 months. And there were huge precedent shifts. So we're really, I mean, I have been of the belief now, as somebody who's lived in this arena for the last 4 to 5 years, that this is way beyond humanly possible, that this is, God is doing something here. God is increasing freedom. And I've been struggling with why that was. I was like, is it just going to get so hostile that we're going to need the protection? Or is like a third great awakening coming where this is the precondition for that? And Charlie Kirk was a dear friend of mine. And the last time we were together a few months before his assassination, we both had come to the same conclusion on our own, which was that we really think that we were at the beginning of a third great awakening with the young people, especially. And it just totally made sense to me now what I'm seeing happening, because I feel like our job at First Liberty is to sort of open the gates because the young people behind us are coming. And I think that's why we see such a dramatic opening of freedom that's going on right now. And again, I don't think we're through. I think we're in the middle of this process. The first time ever, the Religious Liberty Commission, we've never had a president make a Religious Liberty Commission. We've got one right now. There's just a lot of these things happening that we've never seen and that could change the future for the next generation. And I think it's exciting to be alive right now. Hostile, yes, but some pretty good things are happening.
Kelly Shackelford from First Liberty Institute has been appointed to the Religious Liberty Commission by President Trump. What's the purpose of that commission? What kind of work are you doing?
It's, you know, it's a little unusual. Most commissions are created to report to like an agency or a department or maybe Congress. So, you know, you think of like the Social Security Commission, you know, and they do their study and they report. Our charter tells us to report specifically and only to the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Our job is to take testimony, get the evidence together, find out what all the problems are, and then give to the President a list of recommendations of what we're asking him to do that would protect and advance religious freedom into the future. And so we've had hearings. They've been really powerful. Some of the most powerful testimony I've ever seen. And it's like 10 people in one hearing. It's like bang, bang, bang. You just can't believe what you're hearing. So I would tell people they can go back and watch those anytime they're taped and they're online.
Mm-hmm.
You can just look for Religious Liberty Commission and watch any of the hearings. And I am convinced that we have a lot of really good things we can suggest, some which will be immediate and some which, and this has been the challenge. I'm one of the few lawyers on the commission. I mean, it's Franklin Graham, Cardinal Dolan, you know, Ben Carson, I mean, Dr. Phil, some different people, but they all love religious freedom and they're for it. But my challenge is, I was like, you know, I want to make sure we do some things and have the, because I think the president will do what we ask.
Mm-hmm.
That last. I don't want an executive order to be everything we do, and then 3 years later it just gets changed with the next president. So, and there are things you can do. I mean, mm-hmm. The president can ask the Department of Justice to file a lawsuit on blah and create a precedent that then will last with all the future presidents. And that's, I really think that in the next few months we have the opportunity to change the future for the next generation and the kind of freedoms that they're going to have. So it really is a unique time and opportunity. And so it's happening on the Religious Liberty Commission. It's happening in the courts. It's happening in a lot of different ways than I'm seeing.
Kelly Shackelford is President and Chief Executive Officer at First Liberty Institute. You can find more at firstliberty.org. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Happy to do it.
Up next, a different Kelly, Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin from Hillsdale's English Department on Emily Dickinson. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Financial Advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends, the Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771 or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons, premium offerings, unbeatable value just for you.
Imagine walking to your home and instantly feeling relaxed because the colors are fresh, clean, and exactly your style. That's what Eagle Eye Painting does for homeowners every day. Careful prep, protecting your furniture and floors, and a smooth, beautiful finish you'll be proud to show off. We're local, licensed, bonded, insured, and we're happy to help you in English or Spanish. Ready to fall in love with your home again? Call Eagle Eye Painting today at 530-410-4000. 530-410-1317 for a free friendly estimate. That's 530-410-1317 or visit 530painter.com.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out more audio from Hillsdale College on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network or wherever you find your audio and your podcasts, older episodes of this program, plus other great shows like The Larry Arn Show, Imprimis, the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast, and brand new Hillsdale on the Hill, as Hillsdale NDC faculty help walk you up to the 250th anniversary of our country. Hillsdale Audio from the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you find your podcasts. We're joined by Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Franklin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott. So glad to be here.
Starting a brief series as we look at three poems from Emily Dickinson and one in each of our discussions. We begin with a poem called Death Sets a Thing Significant, and it would make sense for you to read the poem before we discuss it.
I'll twist my arm. Okay, well, all right, I'll read it. Death Sets a Thing Significant by Emily Dickinson. Death sets a thing significant the eye had hurried by, except a perished creature and treat us tenderly, to ponder little workmanships in crayon or in wool, with this was last her fingers did, industrious until the thimble weighed too heavy, the stitches stopped themselves, and then 'twas put among the dust upon the closet shelves. A book I have, a friend gave, whose pencil here and there had notched the place that pleased him. At rest his fingers are. Now when I read not, for interrupting tears obliterate the etchings, too costly for repairs. I like that poem.
All right. For listeners who might have heard it for the first time, how would you describe what's happening here? What's the basic situation Dickinson is presenting?
Yeah, she starts with something that, in a way, a lot of us have experienced. When someone we love dies, the things that they leave behind, maybe especially the things that they made, are become precious in a way that you didn't expect. As we record this, I'm wearing these rainbow-colored socks that my late mother knitted, and those are in some ways more precious because she's passed away. And so Dickinson's sort of meditating on that fact that we have that experience of these things left over, these things left behind, especially little craftsmanship. Yeah.
She focuses on these very small, ordinary objects like perhaps rainbow socks, crayon drawings, stitches, and a thimble. Why do those little details become so powerful after someone dies?
Yeah, I think she deliberately picks those seemingly insignificant things, right? They're things that the eye had hurried by. You might not notice it. I think it's because that, in a way, that highlights the transformation of the object. But when the death happens, when we lose someone, then even the most insignificant things, you know, a crayon drawing, by the way, in the 19th century, it's not, it doesn't mean that a child has died. Crayons were used by everybody as just sort of like those pastels, right? So, but any kind of little drawing, a sketch, a doodle, something that was knitted or spun, I think it helps highlight the importance of the person and highlight the transformation, because these weren't important things until the person died.
Dickinson doesn't describe the
this deceased person or persons directly. So we only see them or picture them through these things they have left behind. How does that shape the emotional impact of this poem?
Yeah, I mean, there's this really great moment. You know, at most we imagine, okay, well, here was somebody's fingers, here was somebody's pencil, here was somebody's thimble, right? You get these little glimpses of the person, but the person is gone, and she makes this happen in the poetry in a really amazing way between the second and the third stanza. So we've got that line, "This was last her fingers did, industrious until," and then there's a dash, and then there's a line break, and then there's a stanza break. We sort of pause, it's interrupted. And then all of a sudden, it's thimbles and stitches are the subjects of the verbs. Now the thimble is weighing, and the stitches are stopping. The human agent is gone, just completely vanished from the poem. So I think that's really, in a way, there's a sort of goosebumps moment because of how suddenly death comes. And then these little objects are all that's left. The thimble is, you know, going to drop by gravity. The stitches will not move because of inertia. The laws of physics take over because the human's gone.
Yeah. Talking with Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin about Emily Dickinson's poem, "Death Sets a Thing Significant." Dickinson writes with these dashes. They are everywhere in this poem. Does it do something in particular for us?
She's a very idiosyncratic writer. She's got idiosyncratic punctuation and spelling and capitalization. I think that the dash is a kind of paradoxical punctuation mark because it always interrupts, but it always suggests continuance. So there can be a kind of stop and start feeling. It's not hard and fast closure like a period. So I always think when Dickinson uses a period after a statement, like, hello, heads up, we got to notice that because she's declaring that definitively. But I think she has this kind of interrupted pausing movement that's not a full stop. And it's also just a quirk. She's a really quirky writer. That's what the manuscripts give us, these M dashes.
By the end, in "Death Sets a Thing Significant," the speaker says, "Now, when I read not." What is Dickinson suggesting here about grief's effect on reading or thinking or living on an everyday basis?
Yeah, she starts with this. I would call it an aphorism, like a received statement of wisdom or almost a cliche. Like, in a way, everybody knows this. Once someone dies, the things left behind become important. But we get to that fourth stanza right before when she's reading and reading not. Mm-hmm. And she's making now a personal confession of loss, a book I have. So we've been sort of thinking about, yeah, this is true generally. And then she confesses. And then we move away from those kind of received words of wisdom, which can at times kind of explain away our grief. And she says, no, I have a friend who died. And scholars think that this may be a guy named Benjamin Franklin Newton, who died in 1853, 10 years before she wrote this poem. So the anniversary, they think maybe she's, and he gave her a copy of Emerson's poems. And so they think maybe she's, you know, leafing through that book and thinking about it. We don't really know, but. And then that last stanza begins, right? Now when I read not. We began with words and even words of wisdom, but we ended with tears. Mm-hmm. We ended not with reading, not with speaking, but just with physical manifestations of grief. And, you know, the tears, either they just blur her vision and she can't read. Or maybe they're splashing on the page and like washing away the little pencil marks, which are irreplaceable. He's dead now. You can't call him up and have him reannotate that text. And so they really are, they're obliterated. And that word means to erase, to against the letters, right? And they're too costly for repairs. They're too precious. Those little tick marks at the places that pleased him in that book.
I wonder if the seeing things too demands a confrontation of sorts. We can push emotions aside, and there are other things to do in our life. And when we see something, then we have to make a choice. Do we move it? Do we use it? Do we throw it away? Do we keep it? But there's a confrontation that has to happen at that point with that item and our emotions.
That's beautiful. Yeah, it's almost as if our grief requires, at times, requires prompting. Sometimes it comes on us unprompted, but As we grieve, do we have to set aside some time to confront those objects, those places, those photographs and memories and letters to help prompt the processing that we have to go through? That's beautiful. I love that.
We're in an age where much of what perhaps one leaves behind is now going to be digital as opposed to physical. You have to go through a Kindle and see the notes someone's made in a book as opposed to the pencil marks. Why might this poem still resonate with readers today?
It's a good question. It's a great question. She uses a really amazing word in the poem to describe those little things of those little crafts, right? She says that uses the word workmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing about that word is it contains the word work and the word man. Like the physical thing made by the person contains something of themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that could be true of words typed as well. There's something of the soul in what we type, right? But there, it seems like she's meditating on just those physical objects that we made. We refashioned something in nature, some raw material, and we put ourselves in it. And I think that's how she thinks about those little physical remnants of the beloved dead.
Talking about Emily Dickinson, her poem, Death Sets a Thing Significant. Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Franklin, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Kelly Shackelford from First Liberty Institute and Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin from Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, I'm Dr. Maria Salas, owner of HealthWise Chiropractic. My focus is to help people feel better, look better, and take control of their health with a simple, life-changing plan. It starts with smarter eating choices and adding the right amount of protein to support gut health and reduce inflammation. You'll also receive weekly accountability coaching, a free guide, and a complimentary consultation with me, Dr. Maria Salas. Ready to feel your best? Call or text 530-227-3984.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Planning a wedding? Celebrate the moment with a free dinner for two at Odell Craft Barbecue. With our slow-smoked brisket that melts in your mouth, even Texans say it's some of the best they've ever had. We cater events and weddings of all sizes, from intimate gatherings to receptions of 1,000 guests. We make delicious food and great service, so you can stay present with the people who matter. Odell Craft Barbecue, real wood, real fire, real flavor. Book your free tasting at ReadingBarbecue.com. Again, book your free tasting at ReadingBarbecue.com.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Diamond Crown Classic. Created over a century ago, and to this day, it remains one of J.C. Newman's finest examples of what a cigar should be. Dominican binder, creamy Connecticut wrapper, and a selection of five different fillers from the Caribbean to Central America. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Join me, Mark Levin, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. KCNR, your talk radio.
Donald Trump is doing something that's never been done in American history. Now, what Trump is trying to do all at once He wants to, what I call, reindustrialize America.
Mark Levin is on the radio.
KCNR, your...
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.